People have asked me, why do I want to run for the U.S. Senate? Why do I want to put up with the attacks and insults, time away from my family? Yeah, why exactly was Mike running for the U.S. Senate? Oh, wait, I know. He was doing it because he wanted to be a United States Senator. Let me tell you a little secret about United States Senators. We all love being United States Senators. We all like having a staff of brilliant young people whose work we can take credit for. We all like having reporters ask us for our insightful takes on crucial issues. We all love being called senator. You'll remember that in college, after deciding not to be a real scientist, I turned to a major in behavioral science, where I learned some valuable insights into what makes people tick. Take, for example, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. In 1943, Abraham Maslow formulated his influential hierarchy of needs theory to explain what motivates people. Usually these needs are depicted as a pyramid with five levels. The first two levels are considered basic needs. At the bottom are physiological needs: food, water, warmth, sleep. Next, safety needs, basically security. The next two levels are considered psychological needs. At level three, belongingness and love needs, intimate relationships and friends. Level four, esteem needs, feelings of accomplishment and prestige. In other words, being a U.S. senator. Or writing a theory of human motivation that everybody in psychology pays attention to. After achieving your physiological needs, levels one and two, and psychological needs, levels 3 and 4, the very top of Maslow's pyramid goes to self-actualization, achieving one's full potential, including creative activities. For example, writing a book about being a U.S. senator. Every senator is different. Most of us are doing this to make a difference in people's lives. Most of us are also really into the self-aggrandizing part of the job. The balance between the two is different for everyone. Some of us are more noble than others. I like to think I'm in the top quintile. But we're all human beings. As a human being, I relished my 2014 victory as a vindication of all the good work my staff and I had done in the previous 5+ years. But the glow lasted about an hour. Pretty soon that night, my thoughts turned to worrying about a Republican-controlled Senate, our lagging economic recovery, kids living in poverty, global warming, the humanitarian tragedy in Syria, and the possibility that a real lunatic like Ted Cruz might win the Republican nomination in 2016. Thankfully, that didn't happen. Then I ate something, hugged my kids and my grandson Joe, and went to sleep in my warm bed with my wife of 39 years, thus fulfilling the first four levels on Maslow's hierarchy, which is a pretty lucky place to be. Chapter 45. Lies and the Lying Liar Who Got Himself Elected President. As I watched Donald Trump campaign in 2016, I couldn't help but think back to my own entry into politics a decade or so earlier. Like Trump, I had no previous experience in elected office. Unlike Trump, I was actually bothered by my lack of experience. I compensated for this by absorbing as much information in as much detail as I could. I read everything I could get my hands on. I used my radio show as a graduate education in public policy. I engaged some of the great minds of our time. Did I remember to tell you that Elizabeth Warren was a frequent guest on my show? Have I mentioned that I know Atul Gawande? Indeed, it could be argued that in my defensiveness over not having done this before, I slightly overcompensated during my first run. A stump speech is supposed to be about 10 minutes. It's not supposed to be a discursive 45-minute monologue. But there I would be, boring the hell out of about 40 people at some bean feed, rambling on about my belief that tidal energy could harness the power of the moon's gravitational pull to help solve our energy crisis. or how the Canadian province of Saskatchewan had led Canada to adopt its current single-payer healthcare system, or the precise differences between Sunnis and Shiites. Meanwhile, Franny would be madly tugging on her ear, sometimes both earlobes at the same time. My whole thought process was that people deserve leaders who knew what they were talking about and were curious about the stuff they didn't know yet and who they could count on being dedicated to reaching decisions based on mastery of the subject matter. I figured it was especially incumbent upon me, an entertainer, to prove that I knew stuff, you know, as a sign of respect for the voters. So you can imagine my frustration when Trump, an entertainer, sort of, quickly showed not only that he had no knowledge about the details of public policy, but that he had no interest in learning the details of public policy. In fact, he was actively scornful of learning. "I know more than the generals," he would say. "No, idiot, you don't. You don't even know what the nuclear triad is. Hint, triad means three. It's three of something. Come on, dude." To be fair, though, maybe president is more of a big-picture job. You know, you can hire people who know stuff, like your son-in-law, or some creepy white supremacist. So I let that one go. But I had another uncomfortable moment of deja vu when I heard that the New York Times had published a story about some issue with Trump's taxes. Gosh, I thought, I feel for the guy. I hope he didn't pay taxes to the state where he was living instead of the states where he gave some speeches. I recalled from personal experience how embarrassing that could wind up being. Then the story finally loaded on my laptop. Oh, he had taken a $1 billion write-off. That was kind of different. And as it turned out, he had used what the Times described as a tax avoidance maneuver so legally dubious, his own lawyers advised him that the Internal Revenue Service would most likely declare it improper if he were audited. Speaking of audited, Trump had broken with four decades of tradition by refusing to release his tax returns on the grounds that they were currently under audit. He also refused to provide any evidence that he was being audited, and the IRS was forbidden by law from confirming or denying his story. Also, you can totally release your tax returns even if you're being audited. On top of that, he was the defendant in a fraud suit over his fake university, which he would later end up settling for $25 million, and it looked like his family foundation was little more than a scam, and he had left a long trail of unpaid creditors and stiffed workers in his wake everywhere he had ever gone. But I didn't see anything about a missed workers' comp payment. So, understandable that the press let most of that slide. Still, there was the whole moral turpitude thing. As you may recall, my history of indecorous statements and off-color jokes had created some question about my fitness for public service. How could a comedian who had once written about having sex with a robot, in Playboy magazine no less, be trusted to honor the dignity of high office? The Republicans sure seemed worried about that back when I was running. In fact, so did a number of Democrats. And frankly, so did I. You'll recall the existential crisis I had in Rochester the night before the DFL convention in 2008. Well, imagine my surprise when, in October, I heard a tape on which Donald Trump bragged about hitting on a married woman under the guise of taking her furniture shopping. I was so shocked by this that I missed the part right after where he talked about grabbing women by the crotch. If I had written a sketch where a character said that, I would have been toast. But guess what happened the next day? He didn't drop out of the race. Huh, I thought. The world sure has changed since 2008. All that aside, the thing that bothered me most about Trump's campaign was the lying. I don't know why dishonesty has always gotten under my skin. My parents taught me to tell the truth, but come on, whose parents didn't? Well, okay, maybe Trump's. The point is, I don't know where exactly my particular obsession with lies and lying liars came from. And I admit it's a little weird. Part of it may be that I've always been an incredibly literal person. Here's an example. When Tom Davis and I would go pitch stuff in Hollywood, and the studio executive would say, "I love it," I would invariably assume that he said that because he loved what we had pitched. "He loved it," I would exult to Tom in the parking lot. "We're definitely going to sell this thing." Tom was always skeptical, and almost always right. Even when a studio exec would say, "Not only do I love it, I want to buy it," that rarely, if ever, meant a sale. No matter how many times that would happen, I never failed to get excited the next time it would happen. I never, ever learned. The first time I ever heard of Rush Limbaugh was in the early 1990s when I was researching something for an SNL sketch and stumbled upon a clip from the TV show Rush had back then. At the time, George H.W. Bush was under fire for questioning Bill Clinton's patriotism because Clinton had protested the Vietnam War while on foreign soil at Oxford. In defense of Bush, Rush showed his audience a clip from a different part of Bush's speech. "See," I remember him saying, "Bush didn't question Clinton's patriotism. What's everybody talking about?" I couldn't believe it. Who was this guy? Why would anyone just lie like that? What made him think he could get away with it? And I could not let it go. It made my teeth itch. I'm mad about it all over again, right now. I mean, it was a totally different part of the speech, and he just presented it as if it was what everyone was complaining about, like with no compunction whatsoever. No compunction! Anyway, it bugged me. 2 years later, Newt Gingrich and the Republicans took over Congress for the first time in more than 40 years, which was upsetting in and of itself. What made it even worse was that this same Limbaugh character was their mouthpiece and mascot. They even made him an honorary member of the freshman class. That's when I decided that if I was going to write a book about politics, Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot would be a satisfying title. And as I dug into the research for that book, I found plenty more lies, big and small, to fixate on. Even after the Rush book came out, I kept noticing conservatives in the media saying things that were recklessly, provably false. And every time I noticed it, it would drive me bananas. No matter how many times it would happen, it would engender the same visceral reaction every time. "You can't just lie," I would yell to no one in particular. "You can't." But they did. Even worse, not only were they lying, but there were more liars than ever before, and on more platforms. They had Fox News. They had right-wing think tanks feeding pundits to other cable networks and publishing op-eds in newspapers. They had the conservative internet. They had this thing called Ann Coulter. They lied and lied and lied. And the biggest lie of all was that the mainstream media had a liberal bias, because from where I sat, the mainstream media seemed like part of the problem. They never seemed to call out the lying liars on their lies. Far from it. They would invite the lying liars to come back on the air and lie some more the next time. Not only were these people lying with total impunity, but they were getting rewarded for lying if they could do it entertainingly. So I wrote a follow-up, Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, A Fair and Balanced Look at the Right, about how this was poisoning our discourse. I wrote about how Fox News and the right-wing echo chamber worked, but I also explored how these lies were seeping out of the conservative bubble and into the so-called liberal media without being challenged. Asking whether the mainstream media had a liberal bias, I argued, was asking the wrong question. Their bias was toward getting ratings, and that meant reveling in conflict and sensationalism. And if that meant putting lying liars on the air, then so be it. 2 years after that, I wrote The Truth with Jokes, focused on how the Bush administration had lied us into a war and into two gigantic tax cuts. and into giving him 4 more years to keep lying about economic and foreign policy as president. Sure, the books were more than about just lies. And through my radio show, I started not just exposing the bad guys, but giving a platform to the good guys. And I became part of the whole progressive movement that roared in high gear after 2004. But if I'm being honest, my favorite part was always busting liars. Even getting elected to the Senate didn't diminish the rush of catching someone saying something that wasn't true. There is a flip side to it, by the way. I get paranoid about making sure everything my office puts out is carefully fact-checked. And although we do make mistakes sometimes, I really get upset about it when we do. For instance, there will be something in this book that is wrong. And if I try to defend it as satire, just know that I'll be dying inside just a little bit. So when President Obama said, "If you like your doctor, you can keep him," and that turned out not to be accurate, that bothered me just as much as any Republican falsehood. All this is to say that I care a lot about people in politics telling the truth, and even considering all the horrible things Trump got away with during the campaign, mocking a disabled reporter, attacking a Gold Star family, referring to Mexican immigrants as rapists and drug dealers, calling for Muslims to be banned from our country, I still can't believe he got away with lying so much. Frankly, it made me wonder whether, sadly, the war was over and the liars had won. Back in the good old days, fact-checking politicians was a different ballgame. Looking back now, it seems almost adorable that I made a decent living writing books about catching right-wing Republicans in their lies. What I did was effective, I realize now, mainly because a lot of their lies had the veneer of plausibility. And because at least some of the liars liked to pretend that they were telling the truth, which was, of course, a lie, but which was also part of the fun. But now we seem to have entered an era where getting caught lying openly and shamelessly, lying in a manner that insults the intelligence of both your friends and foes, lying about lying, and lying for the sake of lying have all lost their power to damage a politician. In fact, the Trump effect yields the opposite result. Trump supporters seem to approve of the fact that he lies constantly, including to them. Like a movie that is loosely based on a true story, Trump's fans seem to feel that he's making the dull reality of politics more fun and interesting by augmenting it with gross exaggeration and often utter fantasy. During the campaign, Trump would give speeches that would be just one lie after another, with a personal insult or two thrown in to keep things interesting. And the media would just air these speeches in their entirety. Here's a thought experiment. What would Trump have had to say for a network to cut off his speech and break in with the anchor saying, "Good Lord, I'm sorry, we're just not going to show any more of this crap"? Or at least run a ticker at the bottom of the screen with some underpaid intern just Googling the numbers Trump was pulling out of his ass. For example, when he would say that the U.S. murder rate was at a 45-year high, something he said constantly. "Nope," the intern could say, "not true. Says right here, it's actually at a 50-year low." "Where's that from?" his boss could reply. "The FBI's Uniform Crime Report." "Okay, Jesus, put that up on the screen. Wait, what did he just say about climate change being a Chinese hoax?" But of course, even when networks finally started to occasionally fact-check him in real time, it didn't matter. Trump has deployed a variety of methods to debunk debunkings that have proven startlingly effective. The first and most common is simply to ignore the correction, even when confronted with it. This is why he's continually planting the seed that the media is dishonest. It renders statements of contrary fact highly suspect because you tend to hear those via the media. Trump supporter, skeptically. "Uh-huh. The FBI's Uniform Crime Report? Where'd you hear that?" "You, CNN. Trump supporter. "Ah, okay, CNN, right. And they always tell the truth. Come on, man. Wake up. Another crowd pleaser is to cite an alternate, very anecdotal authority. Trump supporter. Oh, so you think the murder rate is at a 50-year low, do you? Well, tell that to the parents of a college student who's just been murdered. There's also this variant, the sort of ear-to-the-ground evidence that only a common man with a deep understanding of other common men, like Donald Trump, would have. Trump supporter. A 50-year low? That's not what I'm hearing. People are saying it's at an all-time high. As Trump prepared to take office, there was a lot of talk about the different norms he had violated, was in the process of violating, or would shortly have the opportunity to violate. Stuff like refusing to divest from his businesses and place his assets in a blind trust, or using his office to sell hotel rooms to Kuwaiti diplomats and bother foreign regulators about construction projects he wanted to get moving. And that is all terrible. But I really think that if we don't start caring about whether people tell the truth or not, it's going to be literally impossible to restore anything approaching a reasonable political discourse. Politicians have always shaded the truth, but if you can say something that is provably false and no one cares, then you can't have a real debate about anything. I firmly believe that you can draw a straight line from Rush Limbaugh through Fox News, through present-day websites like Breitbart, and the explosion in fake news that played such a big role in the 2016 campaign, and that's how someone like Trump can wind up in the Oval Office. The flip side of the public believing that fake news is real is that they also start to believe that the real news is fake, something that Trump himself has exploited. It is a turn of events that is truly, to coin a phrase, Orwellian. I know I'm sort of farting into the wind on this, but I hope you'll fart along with me. I've always believed that it's possible to discern true statements from false statements, and that it's critically important to do so, and that we put our entire democratic experiment in peril when we don't. It's a lesson I fear our nation is about to learn the hard way. That's why my global jihad on factual inaccuracy will continue. I cling to the hope that national gullibility is a cyclical phenomenon, and that in a few short years we may find ourselves in an era of neo-sticklerism, and a glorious era that shall be. Chapter 46. I attend a presidential inauguration. Senators get great seats for presidential inaugurations. Well, we stand, actually, but it's in a good spot. Standing just yards from where the new president takes the oath of office, it's a rare opportunity to have a front-row seat to history, except that, again, you're standing. When President Obama first took the oath of office in 2009, I, of course, was still in recount limbo. They gave me a decent seat out with the crowd. It was an actual place to sit, which was nice considering that the nearly 2 million other people who had flocked to the National Mall to witness this historic moment had to stand. But it was freezing cold. Plus, I had to get there really early, and by the time the new president gave his address, I couldn't have cared less what he was saying. I just wanted to go inside somewhere and get warm. Anyway, my point is that I was really stoked to have that special senatorial spot to watch Hillary Clinton take the oath of office in 2017. I'd campaigned hard for Hillary, who is the smartest, toughest, hardest-working person I know, with the possible exception of Atul Gawande. She would have been a great president. But after election night, I started looking at the date of January 20th on the calendar with, what's the word, dread. No, something worse than that. It was really, really bad. I felt like I was looking at my own execution date. And not a relaxing, fun execution by lethal injection, but a horrible, painful execution by a faulty electric chair or being slowly strangled by a piano wire. As the date approached, of course, things just kept getting worse and worse. President-elect Trump made it clear that he had no intention of divesting himself of his business interests. He shrugged off reports by every intelligence agency that his election had been, in part, the product of interference by the Russian government. He installed a white supremacist in the White House as his chief strategist. He also insisted on being a complete jerk. Hillary had graciously conceded the election to him, despite the fact that she had earned nearly 3 million more votes than he had. He couldn't even bring himself to concede the legitimacy of that popular vote. Mind you, no one was saying he couldn't be president if he lost the popular vote. It didn't matter. He could have let it go, but no, he was a sore winner. The president-elect actually insisted that 3 to 5 million votes had been fraudulently cast by illegal immigrants, every single one of them for Hillary Clinton. It was almost as if the incoming commander-in-chief had some sort of mental health problem, the kind of mental health problem that you would be disturbed to discover in your kid's piano teacher, let alone the president of the United States of America. Later, when Trump demanded an investigation into those millions of fraudulent votes, it reminded me of O.J. Simpson, who, after being acquitted of murdering his ex-wife and Ron Goldman, vowed to spend the rest of his life finding the killer or killers. Some 60 House Democrats decided to skip Trump's inaugural. I respected their decision, but I decided to go. The peaceful transfer of power and so on. Standing with my colleagues on the Capitol platform, flanked by fellow Senators Kirsten Gillibrand, a young dynamic Democrat, and Mike Lee, a young dynamic Republican, we passed the 45 minutes before the start of the official program doing what senators do, being convivial and generally enjoying ourselves. I warned Bill Cassidy, the Louisiana Republican, who stood directly in front of and a step down from me, that I very well might vomit the moment Trump said, "So help me God." I don't know what's wrong with me, but for some reason, I had expected that President Trump would use his inaugural address to pivot from the awful, divisive transition to reach out and strike a more lofty, unifying tone. Instead, he had crafted a speech that was just as awful and divisive, and so unartful that it seemed he had written it himself in about 20 minutes, or, given his attention span, in 40, 30-second spurts. His message was that all the people on the platform, except for his family and the rest of his team, had selfishly turned the country into a dark, perilous place, the scene of pretty much nothing but American carnage. After that, things went downhill. Angered by accurate reports that the crowd for his inauguration was smaller than those at the two Obama inaugurals and the Women's March on Washington the day following his swearing-in, President Trump ordered his spokesman to call a press conference and lie to the media with alternative facts, a new phrase coined by Kellyanne Conway to encourage sales of George Orwell's 1984. After the public learned that President Trump spent actual time calling the National Park Service to insist they release more flattering photographs of the crowds at his inaugural, it began to dawn on many Americans, including a number of my Republican colleagues, that the new leader of our country was indeed unbalanced. By then, of course, it was too late. Donald J. Trump was the president of the United States, and there's a decent chance that he still will be by the time you listen to this book. Even before President Trump took the oath of office, the clear majority of Americans who didn't vote for him, and a growing number of Americans who were really sorry they had voted for him, were trying to figure out how to fight back against him. As it happened, I had had some experience with all this. I'd basically cut my teeth as a political activist in opposition to the Gingrich Revolution, opposition to the growth of the right-wing media, and opposition to the George W. Bush administration. Because I'd been a satirist since I was a teenager, I had had plenty of experience in identifying hypocrisies and absurdities. I knew how to drill down into an argument to find the inconsistencies that would reveal the underlying mendacity of the object of my derision. I had learned not to be afraid to speak truth to power. And that's what my books were about. That's what my radio show was about. That's why I attracted a following of progressives long before I ever ran for office. It's also why, when I did run for office, the transition wasn't always smooth. The tools I'd used to fight for things I believed in as an author and radio host weren't always useful as a candidate, and they aren't always useful as a senator. But they still work sometimes, and I've had a chance to prove it in the early days of the Trump administration. As you will recall, committee hearings are often prime scorn and ridicule opportunities, and the first order of business in the 115th Congress was for the Senate committees to consider President Trump's cabinet nominees, many of whom were, shall we say, ripe for the picking. I mentioned earlier how I had confronted Jeff Sessions during his confirmation hearing for Attorney General, where, in addition to busting him for misrepresenting his record, I had the bonus thrill of beating up on Ted Cruz. In his questionnaire, Sessions claimed that he had personally handled 4 civil rights cases as a U.S. attorney. He hadn't. I proved it. Later, Cruz, in a sort of typically noxious Ted Cruz performance, dishonestly impugned my integrity as well as the integrity of the lawyers who had actually handled those cases. Right before the committee voted, I spent a half an hour taking apart Cruz's bogus attack, which I have to say was immensely gratifying. Meanwhile, the Health Committee was considering the nomination of Tom Price, the Georgia congressman and former orthopedic surgeon, who had spent his career in Congress trying to slash Medicare, destroy Medicaid, and help orthopedic surgeons make as much money as possible. In fact, Price had enriched himself even after leaving his orthopedic surgery practice to serve in Congress, thanks to a series of extremely suspicious investments he made in healthcare stocks while he was writing legislation that affected the value of those stocks, which I delighted in bringing up at his hearing to be Secretary of Health and Human Services. But the moment when I was able to make the biggest impact came during Betsy DeVos's hearing to be Secretary of Education. But this time it wasn't because I asked a tough question. In fact, it was because I asked a very, very easy question. Remember back in the education chapter where I talked about how judging schools by proficiency created all sorts of bad outcomes? The alternative is to judge schools by growth. Instead of measuring how many students reach a certain bar of proficiency, measure how much progress every student has made over the course of the school year. This is a very basic and very important debate in education policy. But when DeVos had come to my office for her pre-hearing courtesy call, my staff and I were surprised to discover that she seemed to have no understanding at all about education policy in general. So I thought it might be fun to ask her at the hearing about growth versus proficiency. In the hearing, I made sure to give her as much context about this issue as possible before asking for her thoughts. She had none. In fact, she had no idea what I was talking about. It was a shocking moment in a hearing full of them. For example, she had no idea that the right of disabled children to a quality education is protected by federal law. And she suggested that schools might want to keep guns around in case of grizzly bear attack. DeVos offered perhaps the worst performance by any cabinet nominee in the history of nomination hearings. And for the first time in American history, the Vice President of the United States had to make the trip down Pennsylvania Avenue to cast the tie-breaking vote on behalf of a cabinet nominee. As one of the 48 Democratic senators in the unique position of serving as a constitutional check on this president, I have opportunities to fight back against this administration that I wouldn't have had as an author and a radio host. But my job also comes with its own set of responsibilities and constraints. I have to be strategic about how to use the considerable but not unlimited leverage I have. I have to coordinate with 47 other Democrats who may have different political realities or even different political philosophies than I do. And I have to remember that the people of Minnesota didn't just send me to Washington to be part of the Democratic caucus. They sent me to Washington to be their senator. Figuring out how to balance all these considerations is never easy. And as someone who's been part of this fight from a number of different perspectives, I've learned that these judgment calls sometimes look different on the inside than they did when I was on the outside. I can't tell you I'll always get it right, but I can tell you this. I'm going to keep fighting it. I'm going to keep fighting as hard as I can in the coming months and years to protect our children, our values, and our future from Donald Trump. And I can tell you this, too. The work people like you are doing on the outside matters a lot on the inside. The Women's March on Washington was one of the most inspiring things I've ever seen. But ever since the march, ordinary people with a ton of passion but limited time, money, and energy have been wrestling with the question, what can I do now? Everyone has to figure that out for themselves, but here's a little perspective from the inside. First, keep showing up and keep speaking out. The Women's March didn't force Trump to resign. It didn't even stop any of his cabinet nominees from going through. But it really, really mattered. It sent a clear message to the president and to Republicans in Congress that the American people won't surrender their rights or their core values without a fight. And it sent a clear message to Democrats that when we stand up to Trump, people will have our backs. Second, keep being a pain in the butt, including to me. Phone calls make a difference. Letters make a difference. Emails make a difference. Coming up and yelling at me in the airport about how Democrats need to learn to message better makes somewhat less of a difference. But showing up in person makes the biggest difference of all. And we've already begun to see huge crowds at town hall meetings held by Republican office holders in very red parts of this country. Unlike the crowds at packed town hall meetings held by Democratic office holders in the summer of 2009, these crowds haven't been badly misinformed by right-wing talk radio and the conservative internet. But I believe they can make just as big of a difference. I never really had any contentious town hall meetings back in 2009, which is not to say I avoided my constituents. It's just that I call these meetings community forums instead of town halls, and the Tea Partiers never seem to crack the code. But my fellow Democrats vividly remember how jarring it was to be confronted like that, and my Republican colleagues are learning the same lesson. Third, become an advocate, by which I mean pick an issue that means a lot to you. Mental health, clean water, immigration. And look for an organization that's doing work on that issue. Join. Give them your email address. Go to meetings. Become a foot soldier. You'd be surprised how quickly foot soldiers in these organizations can become leaders. And you'd be surprised how much senators like me rely on them for information, for advice, and for support. But maybe the most important thing I can convey to you is that you have got to keep your head up. If there's one thing I've learned in my political journey, it's that it can often really be an unpleasant journey. I've had days where being in politics has felt inspiring and gratifying, a rare opportunity to move our country forward and make a positive impact on the lives of millions of people. I've also had days where it's felt like a frustrating, unjust, humiliating crap show. Lately, things have been trending crap show. And while we don't know yet exactly how bad things are going to get under President Trump, I think we should probably be prepared for the worst. The fact is that he is the president, and Republicans control Congress, and that means we're going to lose a lot of fights in the years ahead. Plus, we're going to have to watch Donald Trump be the president, day after day after day, insulting speeches, insane tweets, policies that are both insulting and insane. This is going to suck for a while. But not forever. I still remember vividly how distraught I was after Bush got reelected in 2004. I also remember what came next. I remember how he got up there and declared that he had a mandate to privatize Social Security, and how, even in the midst of our despair, we stopped him, and how winning that fight was the start of something big. I remember how we recognized where our movement needed to grow and change, and how we built progressive infrastructure to make our voices stronger, and how being part of it felt vital and important and fun. I remember how candidates stepped up to run for office all over the country, even in places where Democrats don't often win, and how much energy there was when I would go and campaign for them, and how we started to feel a wave building as the 2006 midterms drew near. I definitely remember how it felt just 2 short years after that, watching President Obama and his family celebrate in that park in Chicago, and how it felt just 8 short months after that, when I finally got the chance to become a senator and help him make a lot of people's lives better. My story, the one you've just finished listening to, is a small part of a bigger story. The story of how progressives picked themselves up off the mat and made an epic comeback. And now we have to do it again. This comeback starts with standing up for our values and making it clear that no president has a mandate to spread bigotry or roll the clock back on progress, especially not one who lost the popular vote by 3 million. It continues through next year, when we have a chance to punish Republicans for enabling this disaster and take back governorships and state legislatures all across the country. That's how we can put a stop to the voter suppression that made such an impact in 2016 and redraw congressional district boundaries more fairly after the 2020 census. Meanwhile, we can hold President Trump accountable for everything he does. And not just that, we can hold accountable every single Republican who enables him, so that when we kick him out, we can kick them out too. There's a part for you to play in the next great progressive comeback story. But only if you can keep from losing your mind or getting so discouraged that you quit before the comeback even begins. Our political system isn't always fair, and it isn't always fun. Being part of it means making difficult compromises and painful sacrifices. For me, it's meant leaving a career I love so I could be savagely attacked for having had that career in the first place. It meant spending countless hours calling rich people to ask for money. It meant long days of meetings and hearings and long nights of studying my binder to prepare for the next day's meetings and hearings. But even if you don't run for office, in order to be part of determining what our shared future looks like, you have to be willing to give up things like time and energy and money. You have to be willing to tolerate a seemingly endless stream of injustices and disappointments. You have to endure an overwhelming amount of noise and nonsense. And the worst part is, you're not guaranteed a return on your investment. After all, if 313 fewer Minnesotans had voted for me, you'd be listening to a very different book right now, possibly entitled The Bottomless Pit, My Losing Battle to Overcome Depression. That's why, even on the good days, politics is hard. And on the bad days, it can feel downright futile. I've had some of those bad days since I started this journey. Like the day that bestiality ad made my mother-in-law cry. Or the day I had to apologize to Mitch McConnell. Or literally any day since November 8, 2016. But I have a feeling that the worst days of my political career are still ahead. I'm sure there will be moments over the next few years where I'll wish I was back at Saturday Night Live, laughing like crazy in a room full of my best friends, or even just hanging out with my grandkids and giving my brain a break from the constant stream of noise that passes for our political discourse. But I'll tell you this, I'm glad I'm here. and I'm glad you're here too. Chapter 47, Being as Good as the People We Serve. Let me close by telling you a story that helps me keep my head up. Something I love about my job as a U.S. senator is that I get to spend half my time back in my home state meeting with people I represent. And as corny as it sounds, talking with Minnesotans always sends me back to Washington inspired and encouraged. Minnesotans are good-hearted and generous and brilliant. And when I spend time in my state, I see Minnesotans training veterans and ex-offenders for advanced manufacturing jobs. I see them making great advances in clean energy and energy efficiency that could wind up being game changers in the fight against climate change. I see them helping their neighbors clean up after floods and tornadoes. Seeing this stuff always makes me realize how lucky I am to be Minnesota's voice in Washington. Even when being in politics feels exhausting or dispiriting or downright morally bankrupt, it's still a chance to do some good work for people who really, really deserve it. And in that way, the people I represent don't just inspire me, they focus me. They make it possible to notice how screwed up our political system is without letting my frustration turn me inside out. They give me something to hold on to so that I can avoid getting discouraged. Because in politics, it's the people who can avoid getting discouraged who get a chance to make a difference. Even on my worst days, the people I represent give me a purpose that can't be shaken by some obnoxious procedural delay or jaw-droppingly terrible Trump tweet. I represent incredible people, and my job is simply to be as good as they are. 2 days before the 2016 election, Donald Trump landed his gaudy plane at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, making his first public appearance in our state, just in time to spread his trademark blend of hate, fear, and ignorance, this time targeting our Somali Minnesota community. Somalis started coming to America in large numbers during a civil war in the early 1990s. Many families had spent years in refugee camps in Kenya and elsewhere in Africa. About 50,000 Somali refugees now live in Minnesota, many of them in the Twin Cities, but not all. Many smaller cities and communities around the state have significant Somali populations. At the time, Trump was attacking Hillary Clinton's plan to admit 65,000 refugees out of the millions of people fleeing Syria in the worst refugee crisis since World War II. Her plan, Trump told the crowd, will import generations of terrorism, extremism, and radicalism into your schools and throughout your community. You already have it. He wasn't talking about Syrian refugees. So far, Minnesota has admitted 28 of them. He was talking about the Somalis who have been here for years, people who are an important part of our state's fabric. Here in Minnesota, you've seen firsthand the problems caused with faulty refugee vetting, with large numbers of Somali refugees coming into your state, Trump told the rally. He was referring to an incident 2 months earlier in which a young Somali man wielding a knife had injured 9 people at a shopping mall in St. Cloud before being killed by an off-duty cop. The assailant had come to America when he was 4 months old, which makes it kind of hard to buy that the incident was a result of faulty vetting. The investigation is now in the hands of the feds, who have possession of the attacker's electronic devices. By all accounts, the man had gone off the deep end. Not unlike the Iowa man with a Trump-Pence sign in his yard, who had murdered 2 police officers, ambush-style, just 4 days before the airport rally. Of course, no one was accusing Trump of stoking the anger that led to the senseless police killings in Iowa. But here Trump was blaming the Somali community for the knife attack in St. Cloud. You've suffered enough, he snarled, talking about the presence of Somali people in our communities. That's kind of how Trump's entire campaign went. His arguments were rarely rooted in fact, but they frequently carried a tinge of racism and paranoia. And that's what made it so upsetting when he won. How could that be what America chose? Is it really who we are? And if so, what's the point of trying? The truth, however, is that, at least in Minnesota, that's not who we are. The day after the knife attack, St. Cloud's police chief, William Blair Anderson, went on Fox and Friends, where perfectly named host Steve Doocy invited him to comment on Trump's concerns about who is coming to our country. Chief Anderson replied, "I can tell you the vast majority of all our citizens, no matter what ethnicity, are fine, hardworking people, and now is not the time to be divisive." Shortly after the attack, I went to St. Cloud to meet with Anderson and St. Cloud's fine mayor, David Kleiss, a former Republican state legislator whom I've gotten to know well over the years. They assured me that the attack would not divide their cohesive community. Look, a lot of Minnesotans voted for Donald Trump. And when I travel around Minnesota, I meet people who voted for him, believing that only a true outsider could drain the swamp in Washington. I meet committed Republicans who were willing to hold their noses and vote for him so that the Supreme Court would stay in conservative hands. I meet people who bought into the misinformation spread about Hillary Clinton and couldn't bring themselves to vote for someone who is insufficiently attentive to proper email security protocols. But where Donald Trump sees a state in which people suspect and resent their neighbors based on where they come from, I see a state where we look out for each other because we believe that we're all in this together. Trump might have found a clever way to channel the resentments of the white working class, and he sure does seem good at playing the media for fools. But he's just plain wrong about what kind of people we are. Wilmer is an agricultural city of about 20,000 in south-central Minnesota and the seat of Canandaigua County, the largest turkey-producing county and the largest turkey-producing state in the nation. In June of last year, I took the unusual step of inviting myself to Wilmer's high school graduation, not just for the free punch and cookies, but because I wanted to introduce a senior who had been voted by the graduating class to be their class speaker. Her name was Muna Abdullahi, and she had been one of our Senate pages during her junior year. Her principal had recommended her to my office, and my staff told me that her essay and interview were incredibly impressive. So the day the new class of pages arrived in the Senate, I went down to the floor to meet her in person. Muna was easy to pick out of the group of 30 or so, being the only one wearing a hijab, or headscarf, with her page uniform. I went up to her and said, "You look like a Minnesotan." Muna nodded and smiled. As we talked, I was struck by her poise and intelligence. A few weeks later, the ambassador from Somalia came to the Capitol to meet with a number of senators and members of Congress from states with large Somali communities. I invited Muna to come along so that the ambassador could meet her and see that a Somali Minnesotan was a Senate page. The class of 2016 at Wilmer Senior High had 236 members. Perusing the list of graduates in the program, I estimated that about 60% were your garden-variety Scandinavian-German-white Minnesotans. About 25% were Hispanic, and about 15% were Somali, with a few Asian Americans tossed in. The valedictorian, Maite Marin Mera, had been born in Ecuador. As the orchestra played Pomp and Circumstance, the graduates entered two by two, walking down the center aisle in caps and gowns. Muna was up front because Abdullahi was the first name alphabetically. She was holding hands with fellow senior Michelle Carlson, one of two Carlson twins to graduate that day. The only way to tell Michelle and her sister Mary apart is that Mary has a slightly shorter haircut, or maybe it's Michelle. Otherwise, they're identical. Both are tall, both are brilliant, both graduated with highest honors, and both exude the same spirit of pure positivity and joy. The whole day was like this. Maite gave a wonderful speech, And so did class president Tate Hovland, half Norwegian, half German. And both received enthusiastic ovations. I introduced Muna, who got a boisterous round of applause as she took the stage, and a standing O when she finished. When it came time to hand out diplomas, the crowd was told to hold their applause until the end. But they couldn't help themselves. The moment Muna's name was called, everyone erupted, clapping, shouting, stomping on the bleachers, and it continued like that through each one of the 236 graduates. These kids loved each other. The 2 hours I spent at that high school commencement were a tonic for the year of trash I'd been hearing about our country. The previous year, I'd been in Wilmer to help respond to an avian flu crisis that threatened the turkey industry that employs so many in Canada-Yohai County. A number of producers were worried that they might lose their entire operations. But we were able to get some emergency funding to help keep them on their feet. Were these turkey producers Democrats? Were they Republicans? No idea. Didn't care. Don't care. Will never care. Do they care that they have Somali refugees in their community? Yes, they do care. They want them. They need them. They need people like Muna's dad, who works in IT at the Jenny O. Turkey store. Perhaps Donald Trump confused Minnesota with somewhere else. About a week after the election, I spoke to Gerard Araud, the French ambassador to the United States. He told me that in France, a Frenchman is someone who can tell you what village his family is from going back centuries. Immigrants never really get to become Frenchmen. It made me think back to the hideous massacre in Paris the year before. Here in America, of course, we're all immigrants, except, of course, for Native Americans against whom we committed genocide. I'm a Jew, but I'm also an American. Muna is Somali, but she's also an American. On election day, I ran into her on campus at the University of Minnesota, where I was getting out the vote for Hillary. She told me that her sister, Anissa, had been voted homecoming queen. That's who we are. In places like France, they isolate their refugees and immigrants. In America, we elect them homecoming queen. Wilmer is a great community. Minnesota is a great state. America is a great country. Do we have enormous problems? You bet. Do Americans have the right to be angry about those problems? Yes. Are some of those Americans wrong about what the problems are? Sure. Does that make it harder to solve the problems? Oh, yeah. But one thing for sure, Muna is not the problem. Muna is a big part of the solution. Her classmates know it, her community knows it. And her senator knows it, too. If, when you listen to this book, the Trump presidency has gone in the direction we all fear it might, you might think it's strange for me to have ended this book on a hopeful note. But I'm an optimist. And more importantly, I'm a Minnesota senator. And no matter what happens in the years ahead, no matter who's president, no matter how exciting or depressing our current political environment may be, we who have the honor of serving our state and our country in the Senate always need to remember whom it is we're serving and how friggin' great they are. This has been a Hachette Audio production of Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. Written and read by Senator Al Franken. Produced by Lisa Kahn. Directed by Suzanne Torren. Recorded by Tyler Whitlatch at CDM Studios. Post-production by Chris Howerton. Al Franken, Giant of the Senate, is also available in print and as an ebook from 12, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at HachetteAudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2017 by Al Franken. Audio production copyright 2017 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.